Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Join Justin Townsend and the Harvesting Nature crew as they explore the world of cooking wild fish and game while sharing recipes, tips, tricks, and lessons learned from their pursuit of wild food. We sure hope you ate before the show, because you're going to leave hungry. This is the Wild Fish and Game Podcast.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Harvesting Nature's Wild Fish and Game Podcast. You got your host here, Justin Townsend, and I'm joined today by a good friend and special guest, and we're going to talk about some awesome things in the world of knives and knife sharpening, so I'm pretty excited about that. First, I want to give a bit of rundown on what's been going on in my neck of the woods and give you a couple updates on things, and then Colin's here as well, and he'll pass some things as well. So also Kyle too, feel free, interact, comment, laugh, joke, whatever, as we're going through these. So we'll get through this stuff and then dig in. So
right on.
News since me last, so this last weekend was Father's Day, and my family and I went up into the mountains up by Breckenridge and decided to do a little fishing, and we weren't I got a Tenkara rod recently, so that's one of the like reelless fly rods, kind of from Japan. If you guys have ever seen them, pretty cool concept. They like pack down pretty tight. You can take like a little number of flies, you can take a little, it's like a little reel line keeper. And so we threw that in the bags, threw I had some of the Gastronome backpacking food that I got up in Rendezvous, and I've been saving it. And so we took that up, and we're like, all right, we found so a lake we went to last year, right south of Breckenridge, right at like 10,000 feet. I found out that there's another like alpine lake up above the tree line at like 12.5, roughly, or maybe 12. That was supposed to hold some good brook trout and stuff like that. So we decided that we were going to hike up there. And and by we, it was me, my wife, my two-year-old son, and my nine-year-old daughter. And so my two-year-old son went in, like, the backpack. And so we set off up this trail, which is basically, it's a good-sized road. It was also like a Jeep off-highway vehicle road. So we passed some Jeeps coming back and forth. But I tell you, if I was to have to drive a Jeep up that, I would be a little intimidated, because there was like some sketchy moments for some of those. And coming back down, there were a couple Jeeps that were ahead of us that we could see from the top of the mountain. And then we passed like parts where, I don't know if it was brake fluid or transmission fluid or something, but somebody had like scraped a big piece of something off, and there was like fluid all over the rocks. And I was like, that's an expensive trip.
Yep.
But it was, what did we do? It was 3.5 miles up to the top. We went from, like I said, about 10.5 to about 12 and a quarter or so. So it was a good elevation change. The last quarter half mile like kicked my butt, man. I was beat. It was like wet. It was because all the snow was still melting up at that kind of level up on the high peak, so it was all like just running everywhere. And so the road, which was rock, had turned into like a creek. And so we're like pushing through this thing. We get up there, get set up for lunch, eating lunch, having some gastronome, totally enjoying it. And I'm like, all right, you know, I'm going to set up the fishing rod and threw out the other spinning rod we brought up. And like, we're sitting there and it starts sleeting, like sleeting, oh, right? It's June 22nd. This was just like 4 days ago. Yeah, like good pencil eraser size sleet. Like coming down all over us. Like, so we're like scrambling to pick up gear, and like my 2 year old's just like losing it because he's like, this is terrifying because of the sleet. And you know, we're trying to get out of there. We get everything packed up in like 5 minutes and like start our way back down. And finally got him like calmed down and stuff, and then made the hike the rest of the way back down. And I think all in all, it was about 5.5 hour like round trip. And then, yeah, we were beat. But we were beat for the next day. Yeah. But it was great. Like a Father's Day adventure, I was pretty stoked. So that part was fun. Didn't end up catching any fish, but now I think we'll go back again. There was still a lot of ice in the lake up there because it was freezing. So definitely think that had something to do with it. But we'll go visit again. Maybe not on a day where it may rain. But other than that, too, like we're starting to work through our magazine for the summer edition. So we're shooting for mid-July, mid to end July. So firming up all our advertising deals. So if anybody out there in podcast world wants to shake loose some advertising in the magazine, we still got some space and some time to throw that in there. And then we're also working some great stories. So we've got like spearfishing stories. We've got some fly fishing stories. We've got foraging stuff, beekeeping. I'm doing the DIY portion to talk about some lobster diving down in Florida, photo essay, some great recipes as always. And I'm like torn. I've been working on like a smoked wild pork leg, like a whole smoked, like Texas style with the mop sauce. I'm going to put that in there. But then I'm also toying. So I did some dry aged trout, which I talked about, I think, last episode a little in detail. But I may put that piece in there, my thoughts on like dry aging trout, because I thought it was a neat experience. But other than that, Wild Fish Blend is coming out here very, very soon. We're waiting on the order to come in. It's in production, so super stoked about that. That should be out within the next week or so. Maybe out by the time you're hearing this episode. Check the website and see. And then, of course, we've got our wild pig hunting camp in December. That one's still in the books. Seats are filling up fast, so make sure you go visit that and get signed up. Lots of ways you can pay for it outright. We also have a finance option, too, if it's a little hefty on the checkbook for you. So we just want to get you there. Get you eating wild pig and hunting wild pig. So we don't care how you do it. Just come join us. And then I'll pop over to Colin. What updates you got, buddy?
Hey, everybody. This is Colin. So the
that's
Oregon
his,
tag.
That's his tagline.
That's my signature intro.
Colin.
just because it makes Justin snort his drink out every time. So the Oregon tag draw came out this past week, actually just a couple days ago. I ended up drawing the controlled deer hunt for the coastal deer, which is like guaranteed every year. And then no luck on my elk tags, but they were like really low percentage according to like the guy online who does like the percentage points for everybody in Oregon. There was like less than 1%. So I didn't expect to get those. But that's good because I'm looking at archery elk this year, month-long season. Starts in actually exactly 2 months from this Saturday. So looking forward to that. I've been out doing a lot of scouting lately. I have 5 trail cams up in a really hot area. I get probably 10 or 15 photos every day of elk passing by these trail cams. So I'm feeling good about it. I'm sure it's not a secret spot or anything, so there's probably going to be a little bit of pressure. But still plenty of elk to go around for all of us. I also got my Pennsylvania tags, so I got my antlered tag there, which is statewide, and then I'm about to send in my antlerless application, which is, again, almost like guaranteed for PA residents, which I still am. And I also got archery tag for that, so that's a special archery season. So in case I want to go back for like a weekend or something like that, I can do that with my bow. Finally put my chickens outside. If you're listening to the last podcast, I got some chickens a little while back. Chickens are outside in the coop now. They're doing well.
How many chickens do you have? How many chickens?
I have four. I have four Plymouth Barred Rocks. Yeah. They're like the nice. They're like black with kind of like the white stripes in them, like tiny sure. white stripes. Yeah. Supposedly like the easiest ones to raise, so that's what I went with. But I'm looking forward to them. They're doing well so far. They've only been outside a day, but I have their heater out there too, so if they get cold or whatever, you know, Oregon weather changes all the time. So if they get cold, they can certainly go underneath the heater, but they got a little bit more room because they were figuring out ways to escape in my garage. So I figured that was time to put them outside. Yeah. I also got a warehouser company permit this year, which some might consider sacrilege for like the public lands access folks, but ended up Dr. Ben and I both got the warehouser permit, and I'm looking forward to it. It might be a little bit more restrictive as far as the pressure that's going on in there, but looking forward to see what they offer. We did see a couple bulls in the warehouser land last year when we were out during our elk hunt. Just from across the highway or something. So looking to see what that has to offer. Never been on the Weyerhaeuser land. So we'll see.
So you have to explain like what Weyerhaeuser land is.
So Weyerhaeuser is a logging company, and I think this is correct, that they own the most land. They're the biggest private landowner in the whole U.S., as in they own more private land than anybody else.
I'm going to fact check you right now.
Yeah, you need to fact check me on that. But I think that's correct. Regardless, they are a massive logging company. And they have a couple lands out here. But they're the only one that actually costs. You have to purchase a permit to go on there. Pretty much everybody else is free. You just have to register and you get the permit. And you print it out and put it on your dashboard and everything.
So, right? No, John Malone is the, he's a billionaire. he owns, gosh, is that 2.2 billion acres with a, wait, two, no, 2.2 million acres.
Okay. I was like, holy
yeah.
smokes.
Yeah. Billions yeah. a lot.
Oh no, sorry. His net worth is now 9.2 billion.
Okay. There's the billions.
Yeah. He owns land, Florida, New Mexico, Maryland, Maine, New Hampshire, Colorado, and Wyoming.
Wow. All right. Well, maybe I was wrong. Maybe that's old info that I had. But regardless, they own a lot. Maybe they're like the largest timberland owner or something like that. I know they're like the biggest in something. Anyway, they have different areas, and you have to pay for permits to get onto their land. Which, you know, is good and bad. It kind of restricts it to people who can afford it. I'm not saying that it's like breaking the bank or anything, but it also, if you can afford it, then it limits the pressure on there. And typically, people will pull some pretty big bulls off of there just because there's less people hunting. Not as many people taking like the young bulls and everything. So yeah, looking forward to that. And that's really it for me.
Now I'm curious. Sorry, I went down like a huge rabbit hole trying to figure out who's the largest timber owner.
Let's go over to Kyle and introduce Kyle.
Oh wait, hold on. First, before we do that, sorry, Kyle. I want to talk about, and feel free to jump in on this one too. The largest freshwater fish was caught in Cambodia. Did you guys see that?
I did.
Yeah. So
go ahead. Yeah.
666-pound freshwater stingray.
So it's the largest by weight?
It's 13 feet long. It's freshwater. I don't know. Oh, so it beat out the previous freshwater record holder by weight, a 646-pound catfish found in Thailand in 2005, also on the Mekong River.
Huh, wow. Southeast Asia is really pumping out some big fish.
It says that this is an indication that this stretch of the Mekong River is the longest remaining free-flowing section is still relatively healthy. Huh.
I would have thought that's crazy. It was like Piraraku or Arapaima in South America.
Nope. Cambodian giant stingray.
Hmm.
The thing's huge. I don't know. How did they catch it? Oh, they caught it.
I was curious about that too.
New record holder. It doesn't say exactly how they caught it. Could you imagine trying to reel in? Oh, I'm not prepared for this.
Yeah, 600-pound fish.
And like I've caught smaller stingrays while out fishing, and like they have some good fight in them. So I couldn't imagine a 13-foot one.
Right.
I mean, even your little mangrove snapper. Look at the
picture.
Of
this thing is massive.
Yeah. Oh, they tagged with a tracking device. That'd be cool.
Ah, that's kind of... Yeah.
Well, I mean, what? You could see it.
Like, they put a tracker on it, and then they caught it? Or they caught it, and then...
No. They caught it, and then put a tracker on it.
Oh, okay. That's kind of cool. Let's see where it goes. I was going to say, if they're just tracking it, then it's like, ah.
Just dang on something in front of it. Come on, baby.
There it is. There.
It's right here.
You're like, ah, it's Monday. I'm going to check and see where the giant stingray is. We have to go down and try to catch him.
Let's go set a record, baby.
It's like those, they do the shark trackers. You can go on online and there's several like different shark trackers. And it's only like usually when they get close to the surface and but they used to always in the Florida Keys when Colin and I lived down there, the news articles, like people would be like, great white spotted or great white tracking off the coast of Florida Keys. Like it would be like all the time. And then one day, who was it? He goes by the Key West Waterman. If you look him up on YouTube, he's a commercial spear fisherman. We had him on the podcast a while back. Aaron's his first name. I can't think of his last name. Sorry, Aaron. But he was out one day, actually right before we recorded that episode, and passed a great white, and he's got it like he had it on video of like going like this, and he tried to turn around and like couldn't find it again. But then we look, and it was that same week somebody had posted that the there was a great white tracker going off the Florida Keys, and it was up close to shore. And so we think he actually passed like where that great white shark was, and that he had passed the exact great white shark with the tracker on. So he was like super upset about it because he's like, no, man, I wanted to get out and like try to dive and like, you know, check it out. And he's like, I could never find it again. So
I mean, statistics will say that like you're not going to get attacked by that shark, but the like 0.5% chance that you get attacked by that great white, then that's probably going to be a bad day.
For those that know me, I'm not a shark fan, so
I'm a shark fan from a distance. Yeah, I've never seen you swim faster than when those black tips came up to us when we were spearfishing.
Man, no, thank you. All right, let's introduce Kyle. So, Kyle, you work with WorkSharp.
Yep.
And can you tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're from, how you got involved with WorkSharp?
Yeah, happy to. So, I born and raised in Southern Oregon. So, Colin and I are both Oregon guys here. They're out of here in the valley. So they started out like in Beecher, Illinois, and they moved out to Oregon. And I've been working for them for about 6 years now. You know, a little more about me on the me end versus the WorkSharp. We'll get to that. But I grew up in the valley here. Grew up hunting and fishing. Beautiful area down here. Lots of public land when it comes to that sort of thing. We got the Rogue River for fishing and great lands for hunting. And so that's kind of how I grew up. And so WorkSharp was a natural fit for me at a certain point to go there because they're just a great outdoor brand, one of the few we have in Oregon. It's kind of odd that they found their home in Ashland, Oregon. It's like this little hippie town. And there's this like we manufacture like knife sharpeners out of there, man. So pretty cool. I found my way working for WorkSharp, and I've been there for 6 years. I started out actually on the drill sharpening side. They started out making industrial drill bit sharpeners, which is what the name Derex, what they originally were called. And then they started Drill Doctor, which you guys might have heard of. You'll find those in like Lowe's and Home Depot.
Mm-hmm.
And then we moved over into Worksharp, which is the biggest brand. We don't have Derex anymore. Sadly, when that left, I jumped ship and came over to Worksharp and started working for them and got a job doing something I've always wanted to do for Worksharp, which is marketing. So I'm our community marketing specialist, which basically means I run our social media, I run our YouTube, and I help out with influencer stuff. I kind of keep tabs on that, and then working with other brands like you guys and trying to find ways to collaborate, like doing things like the Quest. That's
yeah.
a great example. So, yeah, man.
Sweet. No, it's cool. It's cool to learn a little bit more of your origin story. So you mentioned you hunt and fish. How frequently do you get out? And it's okay if the usual answer I get is not as much as I like, which is
that's ring, ring, ring. Yeah, that's about right, man. Work keeps me busy anymore, but I try to get out there. Like I have my best friend is a huge salmon fisherman. Like he loves going out. So he'll drag me out at least once a year to like go, especially right now they're running. And he's showing me pictures every day. Like I took my buddy out and showed him how to fish. And then I left and he went the next day and he showed me this picture of this big salmon. He's like, we got to get out there. So I'll probably be out in the next weekend or two here trying to catch salmon on this spot that he's all crazy about right now. And then yeah, hunt. I usually almost always get my deer tag and try and get out when I can. I'm going to try and get a little more serious about it this year. I'd love to put something in the freezer. This year it would be really nice to fill it back up because she's empty right now outside of a few leftovers here and there. So,
oh man, I feel you. Like pig camp saved me this summer. And then, other than that, cause like I only took one antelope last year. I had a pretty rough year coming out to Colorado and kind of feeling my way around things other than like small game here and there. It's just like, I need some big game yeah. love for my freezer for sure.
See, I'm the opposite. I need some more fish in my freezer. I need to diversify my protein source because elk tacos four nights in a row is delicious, but it gets a little old. So, yeah.
You hush your mouth, Colin. Yeah. Tacos never get old.
Exactly. Yeah. How dare you, sir?
Nice. Well, that'll be awesome. Get out after some salmon. What do you guys typically do with your salmon up there as far as eating wise?
Man, I typically will just quarter it up and then just do the fillets, and I usually throw them in the oven. My wife's typically the fish cooker in the family. I like to throw it on the grill once in a while, but she does a better job with the salmon than I do typically. I'm more of a red meat cook. She takes care of the fish.
Nice. That's awesome. No, I love salmon. We've talked about going up and trying to either up somewhere in the Pacific Northwest or up Alaska way and like trying to get into a big trip to bring home a bunch of salmon. Cause that's like, as far as freshwater fish, we've been getting a lot more into trout, cause we've been catching a lot more trout, but, I think salmon's probably at the top of the list, but we get like super selective about it just like with fisheries and farm raise and all that. I won't dive down to that rabbit hole, but we like the wild salmon for sure,
man. And hooking into a salmon's like nothing else, man. Like the way they run and the way they fight, like it's just a different kind of beast when it comes to reeling it in. I don't know, you get the same thrill I guess with like a bass, but just such a big fish. And like I remember burning the heck out of my thumb on the first one I ever hooked into. Actually, I didn't even hook into it. The guy that I'm talking about was like, here, you got to feel this, and hands it to me. And like, I don't have the drag set right. And it starts running. And I'm just like, I'm just going to put my thumb on the spool and try and stop this thing. He was just like, oh, that doesn't feel good. And he's like, oh, you got to tighten the drag. And I don't know. I think you learn a lot of your lessons the hard way, I guess, when it comes to all outdoor sports. And that was one I learned the hard way. That's for sure.
Yep. That is. Now you're like, got to set that drag for sure.
Yep, exactly.
No, I'm excited to experience it. I think we'll have to put it on the books. We kicked around the idea of trying to do, like our wild pig camp of like trying to figure out a salmon camp. We're just, I think, probably lean more towards like up north Alaska way or something like that. Just
right on.
Given the status of some of the fisheries. Okay. So, yeah. It'd be fun though. Either way, I think people would eat it up. I would eat it up. I'd love to go and just hang out and like, hey, I can help you fillet fish.
Right?
Let's eat some salmon.
Exactly.
But awesome. So you told us a little bit about Worksharp. I think, which is great. So you guys manufacture a lot of varieties of knife sharpeners, which is
more than ever, man. It's crazy. And if you've got a way you want to sharpen a knife, we can pretty much accommodate at this point, it seems like.
Yeah, because we've got you've got the like the band powered, I guess. Yeah, I don't know the proper classification for each one.
Probably call those like a powered sharpener that uses like a belt to sharpen with. We've got diamond stone sharpeners if you want a free hand. We've got whetstones. You can do fixed angle system, which has been really popular, where it's like a rod and clamp system. Mm-hmm. And then we've also got pull throughs if you just want something super simple and easy to use. Man, you name it. We've got a sharpener out there that can pretty much meet the need. It's just finding the sharpener that works for you.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's an important thing too. Like what you mentioned, like finding one that works for you. So I like coming up in the kitchens, like we always use whetstones to like sharpen our chef knives with. And then there were some restaurants I went out with like, oh, we'll send your knives out to get sharpened by a professional. And I'm like, look, like I'm a cook, like culinary professional here. Like part of my profession is using a knife every day. Like I should know how to sharpen my own knife and like be responsible. So definitely like clued in on that pretty early on doing it. But I like the variety in tools, and as I've grown older, I'm like, let me try this method. And like, mm-hmm. I don't know, I think every method has its time and place. Mm-hmm. You know, like the field sharpeners, I like those. And then I'll keep them like if I just want to do a quick run down in the kitchen with a knife. But then if I've got time, like I'm either going to the whetstone or using the power sharpeners. So
sure.
Yeah. I think there's a variety out there. But thinking about knives, and I put this little note in there just to kind of talk about a little bit about knives, because we get a lot of questions about knives. I think from the culinary world, people are like, what kind of knives should I own? Like, what do I need, you know, for my kitchen, all that. And I'm like, I stick very simple. I'm like chef knife, boning knife, fillet knife, bread knife, and a paring knife. And like, that's kind of the gambit. So with those, mm-hmm. like you could literally do just about anything, I think.
Yeah.
You guys have any additions you think you would throw in that
kit? I wouldn't add
kit?
Much as far as like on the kitchen end of it. I think that mm-hmm. that pretty much cover you. And you get to the, you know, outdoor side of it, you know, then you want something like a fixed blade. I usually, you know, if I'm on the hunting end of it, I'll carry a fixed blade with me and a folder. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, obviously you're going to want a fillet knife for fish or things like that. But as far as like your kitchen knives go, you've got it covered there, man. And then I would just, the only thing I would add is like, depending on what you want to cut. So at that point you're looking at either like a Western style, that's like a wider angle, depending on if you're working with some tougher things, and like it goes to an Eastern style knife, like a shoon or something like that. That's going to be more slicey. That's also going to have to do with what angle they're sharpened at. Those Western style knives usually come in at like a 20, 25 degree angle, probably 20. And then a shoon's going to be steeper, like at a 15. Even Benchmade has gotten in the kitchen knife game, and they call it the Select Edge, and they're as steep as 14 degrees on their knives. So like,
wow.
Theirs are like super slicey when it comes to.
So this is what I was going to sort of ask you, why are the such a variation in angles, and like what do the different angles usually indicate?
Sure. Yeah. So the steeper the angle, the slicier the knife's going to be. So if you're like typically like 15, 14 degrees is going to be a knife that's going to cut. It's going to feel super sharp in the hand. It'll probably be a thinner blade, so it'll have some flex to it. Mm-hmm. Sushi knives kind of fall in that category. Boning knives, things that you want to have some flex to them. And it's going to feel really sharp in the hand as you're cutting through different mediums. But then you're going to get into stuff that's a little bit tougher, and you're going to want a little more meat behind that edge. And that's going to, when you're going to want to go to like a Western knife, like a, I don't know, the big names you'd think of are like Henry Hinkle's or Wusthof are typically mm-hmm. your wider Western style knives. And they're going to be sharpened at like a 20 degree angle. And they're just going to have more, you can just think of it as like, I don't know, and I think of it as like, in broad terms, you can think of like your pocket knife as like a 25 degree. And then you want something like more of a wedge to like cut through harder materials. And that's going to be up towards like, you know, like a machete or something like that. It's going to be sharpened clear up to like 35 degrees. And so that's, you kind of just scale it down that way. And typically your range is, I mean, like super steep, very rare, is going to be like 10 degrees, 35 degrees at the other end of the spectrum. And so like 10 degrees is going to be like super slicey, thin bladed, 35 degrees is going to be like a chopping knife that you're going to use on a machete or say like a camp knife or something like that. Mm-hmm. And they all have their uses and they're all different types of tools that you're going to use for different tasks. But when you get into the kitchen, it's usually 15, 20. And those are either like slicey or, you know, working harder to cut through some meat or something like that. That's kind of how I would think of it.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I think especially like a lot of chef knives, you mentioned it, except for like you go on the sushi end of like the Japanese style, because those are very, and even I think the like the Santoku and some of those are even more slicey than like you mentioned the Wusthofs or the Henkels, your German manufacturers, those guys, like a higher angle, I guess you call it. Yeah.
They get you could probably geometry. Even like imagine it like if you had that shoon in one hand and your Wusthof in the other and you look down and you can see the spine of the knife, that shoon's going to be a lot thinner at the spine and taper down quicker. And that Wusthof's usually going to be pretty thick up at the spine and just be like a wider wedge as it works down towards the bevel of that knife. And that's just because they're just built different for different tasks.
The evolution of the knife.
Yep.
Cool. And then sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was saying and thinking through like sharpening and then so also in the kitchen, like we carry as chefs, you carry hones or steels, like to kind of run your knife over, you know, quicker. What's the difference in honing and sharpening?
Yeah, that's a great question. Honing, you can think of like as you use your knife, the first thing that's going to show wear is that edge will roll. So what I mean by that is you could literally think of like that knife, if you like stood it up and it was made like a triangle toward you, before you see any wear on the knife, the edge will actually roll over, like it'll bend. Think of it as like the knife edge is bending over and you can actually make that bend straight again. So that's what honing is. All that's doing is it's not removing material per se. If you use a ceramic rod, you're going to remove a slight amount of material, but mainly the goal there with a ceramic or a knife steel is that material is harder than your knife is. And so when you run it across there, it will make that your blade conform to the shape that you're running it across at. So it's nice to have a guide when you're honing. You usually want to hold it at about a 20 degree angle. Some hones out there have angle guides on them. Some of them, it's just like muscle memory. But typically, you know, you just hold at that consistent angle and run it across there. And what that'll do is it'll actually take wherever those rolls are and stand them back up into alignment. And that will keep you from having to sharpen as often. When you go to sharpen, you're actually removing material. So that's when you're actually going to take some material off the knife. Maybe there's some damage in there. Maybe the roll's so bad that you're not going to be able to stand it back up. Typically, it's like, you know, this thing's so dull, I need some work. That roll will actually break off sometimes and you've got a flat spot in your knife. One way you can tell that is like hold your knife, look down at the bevel of it, at the cutting edge, and hold it and look straight down at it and have like a light behind it. And you can actually see reflection in that blade. And where those reflection is, that's where you've got rolls or you've got like some flat spots that need repair. And so if your blade is in need of like actual repair, that's when you're going to need to go in and actually sharpen. And that's where we're talking about removing material, creating a new bevel, and getting it back to like factory sharp. And that's where you're going to need something like a whetstone in the kitchen, a belt, powered sharpener that's going to chew some material off, or a diamond abrasive that's going to take some material away to recreate that bevel.
Nice. And I think, go ahead.
When you're honing, like I've always seen it growing up, like my dad would take out the honing right before he's about to cut a piece of meat or something and just do like a couple quick flicks on the honing blade. How much are you supposed to hone?
I hone every time before I use a kitchen knife. Like I get it out and I always just, and it depends on how you store your knives. If you store your knives in a block and you know that they, you know, have been sitting there since the last time you used it and it's, you know, been sitting there, cool, you can grab your knife again. Or if it's in a knife roll and you're the only one that uses those knives. But man, most of us have a knife that's like banging around in a drawer or it's in the kitchen and you don't know if your wife used it last or what it was used for. And so like every time I grab it, I pull it out and I hone it. You're not going to hurt it by honing it. You're going to just make sure that edge is in alignment and then use it. And if you find it, it's, you know, you guys are using it, you're like, this is a little more work than I thought it was going to be, you're probably due for a sharpening. But man, you can't hurt your knife by honing it before using it every time. It only takes a second to do, so why not?
So then that's my second question. When you're honing it, how many times each side do you do it?
Man, it just depends. Like, I'd probably do like 5 or 6 passes, and you know, like usually. One way that I like to check for sharp, and there's a lot of ways to do this, but like, as long as you're comfortable with it, like I touch that knife on my thumbnail. So I hold my thumb at like a 45 degree and I'll take the knife and I'll touch it down on my thumbnail. And if it bites my thumbnail and just holds there, okay, that's a good edge. If it slides down my nail, then I know, okay, this thing needs some work, and I'll hone it some more. And if I touch it again and it slides down my nail, I'm like, okay, it sounds like this thing needs to be sharpened. I need to go ahead and do some work on this because I've lost my edge. It's one way that I do it.
Everybody out there, be careful if you're going to touch your knife on your thumbnail.
Yeah.
Another medium that works well is use a Sharpie. Like that Sharpie, like the casing on a Sharpie. Like you hold it at a 45 degree and touch your knife on it, and if it like sticks to the Sharpie, it's a similar material than your thumbnail would be. It's just I've always got my hands nearby, so
that's a good tip with a Sharpie. I like that, actually. Yeah. I didn't think about that.
Keep us out of some legal trouble if people start cutting their thumbs off.
Yeah. Use the Sharpie, people. Don't cut your
Void
thumb
your thumb, use the Sharpie. Oh, yeah, that's like, Colin, I think you described it well, like kind of taking it out, because that's like the iconic like chef, like, I'm about to cut some meat, run it over super fast. And that's that muscle memory piece, too. I would do it. Yeah, pretty much like you'd move from one job to the next is like, oh, I'm cutting onions, or I'm cutting, you know, meat, or I'm doing this. Like I would move through and definitely hone in between each one so you keep that. I had one other thought, too. Oh, we talked about like from the very beginning, like why are sharp knives important? This always sticks with me. So I knew a restaurant owner and chef back in college. I didn't work for him, but we were friends. And this was right when I got into the restaurant industry, and we were talking about knives, and he was like giving me advice, and he's like, 95% of the time you will cut yourself more with a dull knife than you will with a sharp knife. And like that, you know, we're 15 years later. Like that still sticks in my mind. And I asked him, I was like, what's the thought behind that? And he's like, when you have a dull knife, you have to apply more force and more pressure to get that knife to go through. So you lose control because you're focused not on guiding the knife, but on like pushing the knife down through whatever you're cutting. And he goes, with that, it starts to slide through different angles and slips, and you end up making mistakes because you're focused on the wrong thing.
I couldn't agree more. That's 100% accurate. The other thing too with that is like getting comfortable using your knife, I feel like.
Mm-hmm.
If you get used to using a sharp knife, because I've heard the story so many times, like I sharpened my knives and my wife went to use it and she just cut her thumb because she wasn't expecting it to be that sharp. And like part of that is just getting to know how to use your knives properly when they are sharp. And once you realize like what the benefit of a sharp knife is and how much easier it is to cook and to prepare things, to clean an animal with a sharp knife, you would never want to tolerate a dull blade again, because it just becomes your muscle memory. It gets built up to use a sharp knife. If you get muscle memory of using a dull blade and go and use a sharp knife, sure, you may cut yourself. But the other thing with a sharp knife is you'll have a clean cut. With a dull knife, man, those are ugly cuts. Man, they
dig in.
They're just nasty cuts. Whereas
holes in the hide or whatever.
You might poke yourself with a sharp knife, but you're not going to like do some real nasty damage unless you really are trying hard to do it the wrong way.
Like I got yelled at once. I was cutting parsley, and for parsley, if you use a dull knife, your edges where you cut will be like dark green, and then the
You're
rest
just mashing
of the leaf.
It.
Yeah, I was just mashing it, and like the sous chef came over and he's like, "What are you doing?" He's like, "What's wrong with your knife?" And that led into like, hey, we need to show you how to sharpen your knife. Because, like, I'd grown up and I'd see my grandpa sharpen knives, and I had sharpened pocket knives and stuff. But, like, thinking through sharpening a chef knife and, like, becoming a professional at it, he was like, I'm going to show you how to sharpen a knife. And if you ever do that again, like, you're going to eat all the parsley. And I was like, I was like, all right, lesson learned. So, let's see. We started, man, we talked a lot about this stuff here in the notes here.
Yeah, one thing I think that differentiates out of the kitchen is when you're out in the field. Like, how do you prepare your hunting knives for going out?
Good.
Which is a little different than your kitchen knives. And one thing I've seen a big push in, and I'm not opposed to it, is those throwaway blades. A lot of people are going to that
Avalon.
Their hunting packs and things like the Havilons, yeah. things like that. And then, which is fine if that works for you. I just find that they're silly sharp, those knives are, which is crazy, yeah, which razors. Is great.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't want to get hit by one when I'm out in the field or something like that, which I keep hearing these scary stories about people, and they're right. thin and they break too. It was like one scary story I heard was a guy was, you know, shoulder deep in an elk trying to cut up at the esophagus, and the tip of the Havilon broke off. And so he was like, pulls it out, and he's like, crap, I got to get that piece out of there. And he's reaching up in there, and he ends up like nicking his finger. And now he's got this nasty cut on his finger. And so that's that for me, the throwaway blades. Like, if you're into them, great. But I prefer to have like my fixed blade that I know and use well. And I think if you're any chef that's listening to this, you know, your knives that you like, you know, and use them well. And I kind of think of the same realm when it comes to hunting. Like, I've got this fixed blade that I've used since I was a kid. I know it well. It feels good in my hand. I know how to work hard with it. And then I also have a folder that I bring for doing like fine work and things like that. But the thing to remember, and this is true for anything, whether it's in the kitchen or, but I think it applies more to the field that people don't think about, is like head out with a sharp knife at a known angle. We talk about that. So like you sharpen your knife at 20 degrees when you leave, you'll know when you're out there what angle you need to hold when you need to touch your knife up. So just like you're talking about when it comes to honing your knife when you're in the kitchen, how often do you need to do that? You're talking about doing it between, you know, slicing different vegetables. You're working on an animal. That knife can get dull. You can hit a bone or something like that. Roll that edge pretty good. Then you're fighting your knife, having a pack sharpener with you, like our guided field sharpener, whatever you want. You can have whatever field sharpener you want. It doesn't have to be a work sharp one, but at least have one in your pack to where as you're working on that animal, you can go back and sharpen that knife on that field sharpener and get your edge back. It may just need a hone, just like we were talking about before. Mm-hmm. There's a honing option for that. Or if you do happen to, you know, nick the blade, have a diamond abrasive to go back and sharpen it up. But what you'll find, and what I hear often from hunters, is, man, I'm out in the field and I'm fighting with my knife. And the problem that you're running into is you didn't know the angle your knife was sharpened at before you got out in the field. So then you're trying to hone it at a different angle and you're fighting yourself basically by not knowing what angle your knife was sharpened at when you left. It's a lot easier to just go ahead and hone the same angle and get yourself back to work than it is sitting there fighting. And there's nothing more frustrating than having an animal down, the sun's going down, your knife's dull, and you're like, I just want to get this done. And that's when you start using a dull knife and making mistakes, and you could hurt yourself.
Start trying to rush
and then, keep that, keep that knife sharp and get back to work.
So, that led me into a thought. How does a person figure out what angle their knife is should be sharpened at, or can you change the sharpened angle?
Yes and yes. you can make your knives whatever angle you want, depending on, you know, you just need to remove the material and get it sharpened at the angle you want it to be. Most of your, like I said, on the front end, most of your kitchen knives are 15 degrees on the eastern end. Westerns are 20. When you get into outdoor knives, they're going to be 20 or 25 degrees. And then like your wider, like camp knives will be out to like 30, 35 degrees, depending on how much of a chopper they are. But just focusing on like hunting knives, typically you're going to be 20 and 25 degrees. And the way that I have found that's really easy to figure out what angle your knife is take that same Sharpie we talked about earlier, and you're just going to take that Sharpie and color along the bevel of your knife. So you're just going to color the whole bevel black. And then you're going to go to a sharpener, say like a diamond stone or a whetstone, and you're going to hold it at an angle. So like our sharpeners are nice because they'll hold you at like 20 degrees, and you just hold that angle across as you draw across the abrasive. And then as you draw across the abrasive, it's going to erase where that black mark is. And you can tell if you're coming in too shallow or too deep, and you can adjust to know, oh shoot, this is hitting towards the heel. If it's, you know, maybe it needs to be more towards, maybe it's more of a 25 degree angle or a 20 degree angle. You can adjust and then dial it in from there to know exactly what angle your knife is sharpened at. Cause honestly, a lot of the manufacturers don't tell you. They don't exactly advertise it. And if you pay enough attention to your knives, the manufacturers that are on the lower end of the spectrum when it comes to price, if you look at their bevel right out of the box, they're not always like equal bevels. Like there's a lot of really bad grinds that come right out of the factory. Because honestly, they're grinding those knives by hand in the factory too, which is just another element of human error. The first thing I do when I buy a knife, especially if it's like sub $100 knife, I sharpen it because I wanted to get the bevel reveal even. And I want to make sure, you know, it's sharpened to the angle that I want it to be sharpened at. So,
ooh, that's a good tip too. I like that one too. Thinking about sharpening knives, like even sort of putting it in your own hands. I think it's a good way to know too the angle and stuff like that and work through it, make sure everything's even and matched. Yep. So,
and then I know, and then the next time I go to sharpen it, it's ready to go. This knife I sharpened to 20 degrees. This knife I keep at 25, just depending on what job it's doing.
Man, this is a great combo. I know we're like running out of time because you got to run here in a few minutes, but
you're good, man.
I think like this is awesome. I love the technicality behind it, all of this.
One of those things that, like, you know, as hunters and anglers, we talk so much about like calibers or like broadheads or something, which also we could talk about broadheads too, but like calibers and like the gear you need, binoculars and stuff like that. But then it's like, all right, well, now the animal's down, like now I need my other tool, which is like, you know, a sharp knife. So I think it's something that is often overlooked, but definitely
important. Man, it's a rabbit hole once you get into it. Like, not only angle, you start talking blade steels, oh man, you want to see fights in the comments about like, ask people what the best blade steel for a knife is, and you'll just see
Damascus versus pressed or whatever.
S30V is the best thing you've ever seen. I wouldn't even touch, you know, anything less than S30V. And, you know, there's some truth to that. Some of those nicer knife steels hold up to a lot longer. Their edges hold. They react better to a hone. You know, it's something that you don't have to sharpen as often. So, It's just a wild rabbit trail you can go down, and it's fun. Sure. I like nerding out on it too. But, the world of knives is pretty wild, man.
how does WorkSharp measure up with broadheads? Do you guys have like specific broadhead techniques or guides or anything?
We don't necessarily. I've seen a lot of people for like a traditional just two-bladed broadhead throwing it in our precision adjust.
Okay.
I've got a video of somebody with a three-headed broadhead just laying it down on one of our diamond abrasives and running it back and forth and then honing it with a leather compound. There's options out there. My answer to that is similar to like some of the more elaborate knives out there. If you can get the tool to the abrasive, you can sharpen it. It just might take some creativity to do it.
Yeah.
But we don't have like a dedicated like broadhead sharpener out there. But I don't know that, like, I mean, we could advertise it that way, but mainly it just comes down to, because there's so many varieties out there.
Oh yeah.
Like being able to say like, this one does broadheads. We'd just be getting killed in the comments from people like, well, it doesn't do my broadhead. And it's like, there's like a million of them out there. Yeah. So mainly I just tell people like, if you can figure out how to get your, no matter what it is, a knife, tool, hatchet, whatever it is, to the abrasive, you can sharpen it. It's just, you know, finding the tool to do it.
Right on.
And I think, too, like, you start thinking about broadheads and time spent trying to sharpen them versus, like, buying a new pack of, you know, $25, $30, $50 broadheads. Like, where does that start to go? Like, it's different. I think different with a knife, like, it's more easy to lose, damage, replace a broadhead than it is like a good hunting knife.
Right. Yep.
So 100%. I think about it that way. And like, man, two broadheads frighten me. It's like those removable blades. It's like those things, I know, right? Are sharp.
Gonna slip. And
yeah, I just got a couple packs trying out my bow, and I'm just being like super careful, like using the little key and everything every time. Yeah, I want to slice my fingers open trying to take one off.
Right.
What was it last year? So Ben and I were out elk hunting here in Colorado last year, and we got back in like our last half mile stretch, and like we're down by the river, probably half mile from the truck. And hear like this rustling on the hillside, and I'm like, yes, it's a bear. Like, I got a bear tag in my pocket, like totally not prepared for an elk to be this close to the parking lot. But he looks up and he's like, it's an elk. I was like, it's a bear. He's like, no, it's an elk. And so he like knocks an arrow and like He said all he could see was the bushes, and then you could see the eyes of the elk, and then just like this massive set of antlers. Wow. And he's like, biggest antlers I've ever seen, even in like the elk preserves in Oregon, like wherever. He's like, this thing was massive. And he's like, just as soon as I like moved a little bit to like, he said, I had no shot because of the bushes. Like he was standing like directly forward to me at like 30 yards. So I couldn't shoot through the brush to hit him with my bow, but it turned up the hill and Ben's like, I'm going up after it. And like, he's got his arrow notch, like running up the hill and like comes back down. He's got like a big cut on his arm from like his knocked arrow. Like, I'm like, dude, that's super dangerous, man. Like that sketches me out too. Like,
right.
Yeah.
If you had like a trip going up that, the hill,
goes right. Yeah.
Mm-mm. Mm-mm. So, real quick before you go, let's talk about the quest real quick. We mentioned it earlier, but it's an awesome event you guys got going on and that we kind of partnered with a little bit on it.
Definitely. Yeah, I'd love to share a little bit more about it. So basically, we have filled up 35 Yeti Go boxes, which are just these rad boxes in and of themselves. I want one. I haven't been able to snag one out of the pile yet myself. But we filled it up with sharpeners. We put some knives in there. You can get the exclusive Benchmade bug out. We threw one of those in every one of our boxes. Other gear from Costa, Camp Chef. There's a Phoenix headlamp in there. All kinds of awesome gear. About $1,000 worth of stuff. And then basically we've shipped those out to partners like yourselves all over the country to take them out and hide them in the public land wilderness. And then basically it's a scavenger hunt once those boxes are hidden, and we help, share those clues, on our Instagram and on our email. So, if you're listening and you follow Harvesting Nature, you'll want to follow us as well because they've got a box coming up. I won't say where yet, but they've got a box hidden somewhere in public land across the country. And, we're going to be sharing clues on both channels, and you'll have a chance to just go out and find it. And that's the best part about it, is it's open to anybody. Where I got the idea from was there was an influencer, like I mentioned earlier, I work with our influencers, and there was an influencer who one of the big knife brands sent out on a scavenger hunt to find, especially when 2020 hit, like nobody could go to trade shows or anything like that. So the way they released their new knives was to send this guy out on this epic scavenger hunt. And it was cool. Like he videographed, like documented it all on video, and it was a rad video, and he found the box and all these sweet knives were in it. And I thought, man, that's cool, but I want to be able to do that. Like I want that for everybody else. This is like the everyman's version of that. Like you can go out and find this epic box just by following these clues, and enjoy some sweet loot on Worksharp and a few other brands. And, we love partnering with you guys and thankful to you guys for helping us by stashing those boxes.
Yeah, absolutely. We were super stoked to do it. I won't tell who on the crew did it because that'll reveal where it's
at. Yeah, that'll probably help out.
Yeah. But if somebody pays enough attention, they know like where we are at physically. Right. So I won't share it. Who did it, but it'll be fun. So stay tuned. And this actually timing of this should probably be about perfect for our box. So
right on.
No. Kyle, you have any last thoughts you want to leave us with? Or anything?
I just want to say thanks for having me on, man. I'd love to come back. I know we kind of got cut off here on short on time. So if you guys ever want to have me back, I'd be happy to come talk knives again or whatever else. I love hanging out with you guys. Backcountry Hunters and Anglers up in Montana there, and hit it off with you and Colin. And man, I just enjoy talking with you guys. So I'm happy to come back if you guys ever want to have me. Excited to work with you guys on things like the quest, and you'll see more of me, I'm sure, at some point along the way. That's for sure. So,
We'll
figure out ways.
Yeah, we hung out. You're not getting away that easy.
That's
you're
right.
Gonna hang
That's
out
right.
again. So, all right, Colin, you got a last thought for us?
Yeah, I have two. I don't think we touched on it really how we got connected. Now that you mentioned that, Kyle. So our tents are right next to each other at Rendezvous. A really, really good stroke of luck there. It was really, really good to hang out with you during that week and connect with you. But I looked up the Weyerhaeuser thing. So Weyerhaeuser is is the largest timberland owner in the U.S. and Canada with 10.6 million acres, which is more than the next four combined. So they own a lot.
That's awesome, yeah.
And that is a lot. That was off of Statista.com. Basically, if you search top timberland owners in the U.S. and Canada, and that's of as of 2021.
Nice. So, maybe somebody else made a run for it.
Yeah, if somebody else bought 7.5 million acres in the past year, then they'll have beat out Weyerhaeuser. But yep. Yeah, that's sweet, them. Man.
Well, Kyle, awesome to have you on. We're definitely gonna have to connect again. Maybe we could do maybe like a live sharpening demo or something. Have to back that up in person. That'd be fun.
For sure.
So yeah, we'll think through some stuff, and excited we're involved in the quest and awesome things, because we like knives and we like sharp knives, and because sharp knives help us make good food, which is what we really like. So,
right.
I think it's very cool that we get into some of the whys, and we dispelled some myths and talked some techniques and tactics, which I think a lot of folks can take away and put in their own toolbox to use in the future. So, but no, sure. Definitely take Kyle's advice. Make sure you're following WorkSharp too on social media, and check out their website. Sign up so you get those email alerts for the quest. And then also make sure you're following us too at Harvesting Nature, not just for the quest, but for all the other awesome things we have going on as well. And then whatever podcast platform you're listening to, please punch that 5-star button. Leave us a review. Tell us what we're doing wrong, or, you know, tell us what we're doing right. Thanks, everybody. Have a good night.